This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A little later in the show, we're going to investigate spooky action at a distance and other mysteries of quantum physics. But first, fecal transplants may sound a little gross. Okay, maybe very gross. After all, they involve transferring microbes from someone else's poop. But such transplants are rapidly gaining credibility in the medical world, and new research could tell us more about how to do them successfully for a broader set of conditions. Here to explain what this all means for potential patients, plus other news from the week, is Rachel Feldman. She writes the Speaking of Science blog for The Washington Post. She's here in New York. Welcome back to Science Friday, Rachel.
Thanks for having me again, Ira.
Tell us what's at the top of the list here.
Yeah, so poop transplants. Great, great news for poop transplants. Essentially, there's this new study trying to determine how to make these transplants better. Right now, there's FDA approval for C. diff infections, one kind of bacteria, horrible, horrible infections. And essentially, doctors just want to make this broader. They want to treat other kinds of stomach infections with poop transplants. And they also would like to investigate, you know, looking at weight loss, anything that might be related to the microbiome of the stomach, which frankly could be anything. So this study looked at patients, and instead of just looking at the species of bacteria in them, it looked at the specific strains. And it turns out that when you look at that resolution, you get this very interesting picture of what happens when you transplant the microbial matter. It looks like a lot of the donor's microbes actually coexist with the patient's microbes. They're just different strains of the same bacteria. And that's not what doctors really thought was happening. They thought that the good bacteria was always beating out the bad bacteria. They also noticed that having the same species but different strains made the donation more likely to take, probably because those bacteria didn't seem like foreign invaders. So it's basically showing that we probably need to think less about having these super healthy donors who are great for everyone and more about what individual donor might be good for an individual patient.
So you have to tailor it a little bit more.
Yes.
To the person.
Right. And there were other studies coming out this week on the microbiome trying to determine what is that ideal gut microbiome. And they found a lot of interesting things about what makes your microbiome vary, but they were very frustrated. They were not able to conclude that there's one healthy gut microbiome. So mm-hmm. It really may be an individual tailored therapy.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on to the very strange happenings at the Large Hadron Collider. Tell us about a weasel.
Right. So at the LHC, there are not going to be any experiments for the next few days. And it's because of a weasel, an actual weasel, that presumably chewed on some wiring and caused a power cut. And people are loving this story because it's so funny that this, you know, the biggest scientific instrument in the world, it's 17 miles in circumference, and this little weasel has shut it down. But actually, in 2009, there was a shutdown that they blamed on a bird. Some people say the bird actually dropped a baguette onto the wiring.
Right, I remember that one.
Yeah, the baguette is unconfirmed, but they do think it was bird-related. So yeah, the weasel is unfortunately deceased. But the LHC will be fine. It just needs a few days to make sure everything's okay.
So they got fried by the wiring? The weasel did?
Well, yeah, the weasel did get fried, unfortunately. That science-hating weasel.
So they put a guard or a fence or anything? it's an expensive piece of equipment, Rich, all right?
Right, but it's also out in the countryside, so there, you know, stuff happens. But, you know, maybe they will try to do some pest control. I'm not sure.
Yeah, somebody permanent, running up and down there. Also, let's talk about the bed bugs. There's a story about bed bugs have a sense of aesthetics.
Yes. Bed bugs apparently have favorite colors. Researchers found that they prefer red and black over all over other colors, and they strongly dislike yellow and green. But you shouldn't go out and buy new sheets just yet because the thing is that bed bugs spend most of their time in the dark. And generally, when you turn on your lights, bed bugs have already picked their hiding places. So if you had black sheets and your lights were out and a bed bug hid in your bed, they probably wouldn't notice or care that those sheets were black or yellow or whatever. It's only when the researchers had them doing this in the light that they were able to see the colors and had a preference. So there may be some applications for designing better traps, but the truth is, because of the way bed bugs live, mostly in the dark, it's probably not going to have super strong implications for New Yorkers trying to keep them out of their apartments.
Darn.
I know.
Do we know why they have a preference for these colors?
No. And, you know, there was some interesting nuance. They always really liked red and black, and they always really didn't like yellow and green. But in terms of other colors, there was a lot of variation based on age, sex, whether they were hungry or not. So it's really not clear, you know, what's going on in their little heads.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Lastly, an astronaut finishes a marathon in space on the space station.
Yes. Right? Tim Peake already broke a record by being the first official British astronaut to be on the International Space Station. He's not the first astronaut to run a marathon there. That was a U.S. astronaut, Sunita Williams, in 2007. But he did break a record by beating her time. So he is now the fastest marathon runner in orbit. He ran the London Marathon. And his time was actually within a few minutes of the time he made on Earth in 1999, which I thought was very impressive because he had to do it with the muscle weakness associated with space travel and also wearing this very bulky harness to keep him tethered to the treadmill. So He did a good job. It's the time to beat.
Well, shouldn't they be keeping separate male and female records?
Right.
The International Space Station for marathon running?
Yes. So his is the time to beat for male astronaut marathon runners now.
Yeah. Maybe it's an annual event.
I think it should be. I mean, the last one was back in 2007. So we really should try to do this more than once every decade.
Yes. Or else you get rusty. You know?
Yeah. I mean, I guess being an astronaut is kind of a lot of work already. So maybe training for a marathon is more than most of them want to do. But
all right. Well, we'll keep track.
Thank you.
Rachel Feldman writes a blog for The Washington Post. She's here in our New York studio. Her blog is Speaking of Science. And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. Here's a question. What weighs about 3,500 pounds, lives in the Atlantic Ocean, and has over 90,000 followers on Twitter? Give up. Well, it's a shark named Mary Lee. And animal researchers are putting data from living things like sharks onto social networks. You might get a tweet telling you just when your favorite shark, maybe Mary Lee, is going to come swimming by that week and you get a tweet. Here to talk about the potential ups and downs of tweeting sharks is science writer Gloria Guibe. And you can read her story about Mary Lee and other sharks on social media in Undark magazine. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Well, so what's good about this?
So as you might expect, sharks have kind of a reputation problem. We still really think of them as man-eaters and being dangerous to us, but the reality is that humans kill over 100 million sharks every year. That's a conservative estimate. So a lot of shark researchers see putting their data online and making these social media accounts as putting a friendlier face on sharks, because a lot of the conservation efforts that have worked really well for animals are animals like whales and eagles that people really love and identify with.
Yeah, because they're sort of getting killed out of almost into extinction in some places, aren't they? They kill 100 million of them a year?
Exactly, yeah. That's the running estimate, but some people say it's higher, and it's really a problem where shark fin soup is popular, which is big in Asia.
Mm. Do towns like knowing there are sharks out there? Can you tweet and say the shark is in, you know, the neighborhood?
Well, that kind of gets into the bad side of it. Some people are really excited to learn that there's a shark swimming offshore, but some people might not realize that they're there. And hearing that there's a shark nearby on social media might be a little bit of a nasty surprise.
Well, I mean, I guess don't the bathers have a right to know there's a shark out there?
They do, and there are a lot of different ways. In Australia, they've been experimenting with tweets being sent out when a shark passes a certain buoy so that bathers can check their phone and see there's a shark nearby. Maybe we should get out of the water.
Yeah, I can understand that. And summertime and Jaws is coming up again, so I can understand the concern. And there has been criticism of how the sharks are tagged, hasn't there?
Right. So one of the really visible groups, it's called OSearch, and they are kind of the standout group because a lot of the sharks on social media come from their tagging program. And they have a great science program, but their communication is not always great. So one incident that's kind of caught people's attention is in 2012, there was a body surfer attacked in South Africa. And that happened just 2 days after OSearch used chum in the area, which is basically just dead, bloody fish. And a lot of people think that this chum might have changed the shark's behavior and made it attack a human. So now people are asking OSearch, are you using chum or are you not using chum? And they haven't really been clear about that. So those methods make people a little less trusting of people tagging sharks, despite the fact that it is a really valuable tool for researchers.
Well, speaking of that, are there other animals on Twitter tweeting as they go about?
There are, actually. There's a cougar in Los Angeles that's kind of an urban adapter who has a Twitter account, and there was a snake that escaped from the Bronx Zoo that has its own Twitter account, and I think it's mostly angry that it's back in the zoo.
Yeah. Not to mention the fact that you can't tweet back.
Exactly. It's a little harder to tweet back.
Shark has 90,000 followers.
What? Yeah, it's surprising to look at these sharks' feeds and see how much people really interact with them.
Yeah, well, the animals are always very popular, and certainly once we'll watch for their Facebook pages, I guess. That would be next.
I'm sure that'll be next.
Claudia, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Definitely. Thanks for having me.
Happy tweeting to you. Claudia Guy is a freelance science writer, and you can read her story about sharks on social media in Undark magazine. When we come back, we enter the realm of physics that sometimes seems more like philosophy, Twilight Zone. It's the quantum world. Spooky action at a distance. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. I want you to try something. I want you to look around and observe the world around you for a second. Me, I'm sitting here in the Sci-Fi Studios. There's a mic in front of me, a table right there. I have my scripts, I have my questions. I even have a glass of water. There you go. Now, think. What if all this stuff, all these objects, this space, this reality we live in, is just an artifact of some underlying quantum structure? Could it be that space and matter and things, the only stuff we know, the only stuff that feels real, are actually the exception and not the rule to the overarching order of the universe? Or as one of my guests writes, when you stretch an arm to grasp a pencil and it's just outside your reach, something is acting to thwart you, creating what you perceive as distance. And when we ask what that machinery could be, we have arrived at the outermost frontier of modern physics. Well, this hour we're going to be exploring that frontier of modern physics. To paraphrase Rod Serling, a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. So fasten your seatbelts. George Musser is the author of Spooky Action at a Distance, the phenomena that reimagines space and time and what it means for black holes, the Big Bang, and theories of everything. And we have an excerpt at sciencefriday.com/spookyaction. He's also contributing editor at Scientific American and Nautilus Magazine. Welcome to Science Friday, George.
Thanks for having me.
And you're very welcome. Also with us today is Shohini Ghosh. She's an associate professor of physics and computer science, and director of the Center for Women in Science at Wilfrid Laurier University in Waterloo, Canada. Welcome to Science Friday.
Great to be here.
Let me begin with George, first with the little experiment explanation of what the title of your book means, Spooky Action at a Distance. This was something that Einstein came up with, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a thought experiment he did to explore some of the implications of quantum physics. And actually, he first began to figure out what this phenomenon was in 1909. It actually predates even his famous 1935 paper with Podolsky and Rosen, the EPR paper that everyone now cites. And there's a lot of different metaphors and ways you can think about it, but the way I like to think about it is coins, flipping magic coins. Mm-hmm. So you can prepare these coins together. Usually it's done with some kind of optical crystal. I could give you one coin and you would go home and keep it in your pocket, and I would keep one coin in my pocket, and later that evening maybe we would measure the coin. We would flip it and mm-hmm. would see whether it comes up heads or tails. And that actually corresponds to the different properties of these particles. And if I found it came up heads, you flipped your coin, it would come up heads too. If I flipped tails, you would get tails. So there's this kind of synchronicity between these two objects. And that's really the phenomena that Einstein was very troubled by. He thought it meant action at a distance, or what he called spooky action at a distance, to kind of heighten its mystery.
Right, and one of the great mysteries about it is that my coin and your coin could be separated at the extent of the universe, far apart, right?
Other sides of the galactic empire. They could be anywhere,
and
really.
They would flip at the exact same time as you flipped your coin, my coin would flip.
Exactly.
And that's why it's such a spooky action.
Exactly. It seems to just not be amenable to a mechanistic, ordinary description, another ordinary explanation of it.
Hmm. Shohini, one of the things you study in this is this spooky action at a distance called quantum entanglement. Is that what we're talking about here?
That is exactly what we're talking about, and it is definitely very strange.
is it spooky to you?
It's pretty spooky. I don't think we understand the mechanism, so the theory actually is quite well tested, the theory of quantum physics. And every experiment we do seems to verify this mathematical structure, which is what we call the theory. So according to the theory, it's very precise and absolutely perfectly mathematically logical and consistent. But what it actually means, the mechanism by which these particles are connected, that part we still are debating.
Because in order to separate it that far, you have to go faster than the speed of light, right? The knowledge has to travel faster than the speed of light, George? Does it violate that or does it not? And that's the spooky part, that it does not?
Well, Einstein's concern was precisely that, yes, it violated, or it needed, I should say, to violate. So we have to kind of separate a couple levels here. First, we have this phenomenon at the time of Einstein's paper. It was theorized out of the theory, but we've since observed it. And then we have to ask, how do we interpret the phenomenon? And that's where we get into, oh, God, do we need to have something going faster than light? Because the particles in question could be light. They could mm-hmm. be flying apart from each other fast at the speed of light, in which case to catch up with them, you'd have to move faster than light. So that is a problem, because if you accept relativity theory, and Einstein, having invented relativity theory, certainly did, that would seem to violate his principle that, or his implication of the theory that nothing can outrun light. Now, I think the thinking today is it's probably not an issue. For one thing, you can't use this spooky connection to transmit information or exert some kind of causal influence of one place on the other. You can't build an Ansible or a subspace radio or one of these science fiction-y types of devices with it. So probably it's more subtle. It's probably not an overt violation of relativity theory or this going faster than light question. Mm-hmm. It's more subtle. It's indicating something deeper about space and time.
Yeah, well, I want to get into that. Shohini, how do we actually observe this in real life?
So there's been a lot of experiments in recent years, starting from I'd say around the 80s, people started really getting interested in this idea. And typically, in order to generate these kinds of entangled particles, what's done is you shine laser light on a nonlinear crystal. And every once in a while, one of the incoming particles of light, which is called a photon, will generate pairs of photons. And those photons are entangled in some property that they have, specifically polarization. So there's different polarizations of light. So both photons will come out either jointly being horizontally polarized or both being vertically polarized. Now, what's weird about it is that we don't think of it as, oh, like a regular coin where you know that, you know, it's either heads or tails. It's just that if you don't look, you don't know. No, in the case of the photons, the way we have to think about it in the quantum level is that they're both horizontal and vertical polarized at the same time. So if we only look at one of the particles, there's really no information because there's sort of this probabilistic description. There's a 50% chance that it's horizontally polarized, 50% of the chance it's vertically polarized. However, what we know for sure, and this is the power of this entanglement, is that if we measure one of the photons to be horizontal, the other one is instantly horizontal as well. Or vice versa. So that's how the experiments are done. You can actually generate these polarized photons and then detect them and yeah, build statistics.
Well, George, you say in your book, and I'm going to quote this, when we can no longer take space for granted, I mean, is spooky action of the distance possible because the distances between the objects really don't exist in another? In other words, the spooky action may be happening in another realm of physics we're not aware of. So the objects are really not separated, so they can happen right like they're next to each other. Space, the way we think about it, is not real.
Yeah, and I
have oversimplifying that because it's Rod Serling talking to me.
It really does sound like Rod Serling. I love the old Twilight Zone episodes, and it does sound like something out of them. So, I mean, again, scientific honesty requires me to say that I'm just presenting a certain interpretation. There are other alternative interpretations. Mm-hmm. But yes, the proposition that I'm defending in this particular book is that the particles are acting as though they're not separated by distance. They're acting as though they're actually co-located. And there's no ginormous gap between them. And that could be an explanation for why they can behave in unison as they seem to.
And so space may be the exception, not the rule, as you're right. Most proposed unified theories of physics suggest that the vast majority of the universe's possible states are non-spatial.
Yeah, and this we've
constructed space for our own convenience, or it pops out of the mathematics.
Yeah, I don't think we humans can take credit for having constructed space. I mean, that would be a great accomplishment if we could do that. But no, the universe has somehow arranged itself such that it has this kind of spatial-temporal structure to it, and that's the mystery. And this is where the whole entanglement question and other types of non-locality we see in physics intersects with the search for a unified theory of physics. Mm-hmm. So the type of stuff that Carlo Rovelli works on in loop quantum gravity, Brian Greene's work in string theory and others, out of those theories comes the idea that space is a construction. It's built like Legos, like dumping a bunch of Legos on your floor and piecing them all together and, hey, space. But if you can do that, as you say, then you know, I could piece those same Legos together and get something not space. And your kind of imagination begins to just rebel at that point. You go, whoa, what could not space be? What could the absence of space be?
Shohini, what is the absence? How can we have the absence of space?
That's a really good question. In fact, I'll go one further and bring into this discussion not just space, but what we consider reality. Because, in fact, quantum physics tells us, you know, through things like entanglement and other very strange properties, that our description, this model, may not actually have anything to do with what we would describe as reality. So far, all of physics has been about trying to explain this real universe around us. But now we have a theory where if we try to ascribe reality to it, that particular reality either is very strange, where everything is connected non-locally, or if we want to preserve locality, then there is not even a reality until we observe something or do something. So I think we are sort of having to rethink even this notion of what we perceive, whether or not it is actually related to just information and our senses, or is it actually connected to something that we call reality at all? So yeah, it's a surprising way to have to go back and rethink what even physics is all about. Maybe this particular theory is just our description. It's an information theoretic view where we say this is only our description of what we can observe. It tells us nothing about what's really happening, perhaps.
Wow.
I'll leave it there.
That's starting less than zero if it tells us nothing about what's really happening. Isn't that the whole idea of physics?
Exactly.
Is to find out how nature works? And if this tells
us
nothing...
Exactly right.
Where has that gotten us? I mean, it's more like we're into philosophy then.
Absolutely.
And physics often is, I mean, and it should be, foundational physics is at the intersection of metaphysics and physics. It's kind of at that boundary. And so these questions should seem philosophical to us. In fact, we have to bring all the apparatus, not just of experimental and mathematical physics, but of philosophy to try to understand it.
Hmm. It's amazing. I'm talking, just if you're joining us, I'm talking with George Musser, author of Spooky Action at a Distance, a really good book. I've read a lot of. I don't know how you got all of this together in one spot and did this, George. Also, Shohini Ghosh, Associate Professor of Physics and Computer Science, Director for the Center for Women in Science at the Wilfrid Laurier University in Waterloo, Canada. And you're listening to Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking more about, you know, when I read the book about physics and you tell great personal stories in the book, George, it seems to me that physics really is a personal thing, that scientists who study physics put their whole body and soul into believing what they're doing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is why they're doing physics as opposed to anything, the other things we can do in life, just like an artist or really anybody who's engaged in their profession will throw themselves into it. And isn't that one of the great joys of life, to have that privilege to do that? And I think in the case of non-locality and these quantum entanglement and other types of questions, because they're at the cutting edge, they demand the full person. They demand the full involvement of all our faculties in trying to understand these questions.
Shohini, do physicists need big egos to do what they're
doing? Actually, it's quite the opposite, I think. We are constantly humbled by how little we know. And that becomes a passion to say, you know, there's so much more to know. And, you know, the ultimate mystery is the mystery of how this universe works. So I think what the main driver, I would say, for myself for sure and a lot of my colleagues is curiosity. It's about finding out about the universe. And in order to do that, absolutely, you have to have passion and you absolutely have to be willing to actually fail. So there's a lot of failure involved in doing this kind of work because you have to follow these paths to the very end and see maybe you are on the wrong track, you don't know what you're going to find. So you have to be willing to step back and give up at some point and try different routes. So it's absolutely something that needs a lot of commitment for sure. And there's absolutely a sense of achievement mm-hmm. when you do succeed for sure. Well, so in that sense, yeah, that's good for our egos.
Mm-hmm. Well, George writes in his book, plenty of the greatest advances have their origins in wrong ideas, which breathes life into ideas by what it provokes.
Absolutely. I think this is physics by accident is what we call it. It's a really, really important approach to doing physics.
So failure is an option in physics.
Absolutely.
Sort of.
Yeah, I think the thing about error and failure is I think it introduces novelty into what we do. It also, because otherwise we're just stuck in our rut. So you almost need a mistake. And this is how natural selection works in the biological world. And I think something similar happens in the intellectual world as well.
Is physics stuck now because it can't explain this? It hasn't no unify. I mean, are we at a plateau where we need either new physics or a new idea that'll talk about how the spooky action, what's the mechanism, how it works? We know that it works, but we don't know how it works.
It's hard to say. I mean, it's something we'll know really only in retrospect, I suppose. On the one hand, there's just a burbling of ideas. It's very exciting to go to conferences and hear people excitedly talk about their ideas and, wow, let's go have coffee and talk about your idea. And it's such a great to and fro that's occurring. But I will say that I do get the sense that the physicists need some new input. Mm-hmm. It could either be an Einstein arising and piecing together things people hadn't seen before that were there but hadn't been appreciated. Or maybe even better, nature has to give us guidance. We need some experiment. We need something that's actually just knocking us on the head and say, hey, guys, here's a new data point, or here's a new experiment, or here's a new observation that is really going to guide us forward.
Maybe some particle coming out of the Large Hadron Collider or something like that.
We can only hope, definitely.
All right. Shohini, you agree? I got about 30 seconds before the break, yeah?
Yeah, I think that's certainly true that there's a lot of different aspects that we're still exploring. And keep in mind that, yes, we've had quantum physics since, you know, the beginning of the 20th century, but that's still, you know, about 100 years, whereas we've had older theories that have lasted centuries before that new idea came along. So maybe we're still, you know, this is early days, and I agree that we need more data, and I think we are getting more data from, you know, cosmology, from LHC and elsewhere. It's exciting times, actually.
Yeah, we've got more data coming in from our phone calls. Our number 844-724 8255 if you'd like to join the discussion. You can also tweet us at SciFry. We're going to take a break and come back and talk lots more with Shohini Ghosh and George Musser, author of Spooky Action at a Distance. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the spooky, weird world of quantum physics with my guest, Shohini Ghosh, Associate Professor of Physics and Computer Science and Director of the Center for Women in Science at Wilfrid Laurier University in Waterloo, Canada. George Musser, author of Spooky Action at a Distance, and we have an excerpt of his book on our website at sciencefriday.com/spookyaction. And I want to bring on another guest now who's built a computer game. It's me, you, anybody, participate in a quantum physics experiment. No degree required. I have played this game online. It is addictive, and it's quite easy, but it's hard, so to speak. Jacob Schursen is director of the Interdisciplinary Center at Aarhus University in Denmark and associate professor of quantum physics there. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much. Hi.
I want to tell the listeners that if you want to play the game, you can check it out at scienceathome.org. Jacob, tell us why you're enlisting the help of the masses here. What are you trying to pull off exactly?
I'm an experimental physicist, and I'm trying to build something called a quantum computer. And in this quantum computer, we have to be able to pick up individual atoms. And atoms are, as you have talked about, wavy things. So that means that as we try to pick them up, they actually start to slosh when we move them around. So they start to move around just like a cup of coffee would move when you start to move quickly with it.
And so as I play the game, you have to move the atom from one place to another, and it is sloshing, right? And you have to keep it from sloshing out of the spot like the coffee would go over the top. It's not easy.
Exactly. And after having moved the atom, if it's still sloshing, then our quantum computation will give the wrong results. So our basic problem was, I'm building the experiment. We don't have any solutions on how to move these atoms around. Our best computers have failed at finding solutions for us. So in our desperation, we turn to something completely new, gamification of quantum physics.
So you think people are better than computers at solving your problem?
Well, initially, I didn't think so. I just thought that was the last option we had, and it would be a lot of fun trying it out. Now I've been so much surprised by reality and how good the players have been. And that's exactly what we reported in Nature 2 weeks ago now.
And you said you think this game allows people to use their so-called quantum intuition built into us. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that so you've just talked about how weird quantum physics is, and that means that you sometimes sort of give up trying to understand quantum physics, which means that people tell me that I'm crazy because I want to enlist the help of normal people because you cannot understand it. But in games, you actually don't have to really rationally understand what you're doing. You just have to get a sense of the rules of the game, and then you will just, by your intuition and your desire to do well in the game, you'll actually just do well. You'll start to take advantage of these subtleties and oddities of quantum physics.
Shohini Ghosh, what do you make of this computer game, the fact that humans can solve these quantum problems faster than machines?
This is so cool. It's such a great idea. You know, this reminds me of, you know, when I teach first-year physics in my classes, Newton's laws, you know, when we get into that stuff, you know, that's quite challenging to a lot of students. And I usually tell them, you know, when you're walking, you know, jumping, running, playing, your body already knows Newton's laws. It's not like you have to stop and then calculate all of the forces and then, you know, start walking. Your mind already does this unconsciously. So this is reminding me of that same thing, where there are obviously some unconscious ways that we can recognize patterns. And in this case, for this specific task, it seems to be a really interesting, novel way of solving this problem, which, you know, our standard programming of computers doesn't seem to get in the same way. So who knows what the possibilities are.
And George, you played the game?
I have indeed. It is like carrying a cup of coffee across the room, which I never was very good at. So I haven't probably got the highest score, but it's fun to play. And it also fits into what I think I've been trying to do over the years, as Shohini has, and that's bring quantum physics down to the human everyday level. And I think you can do that. You can actually almost if you know how to look, see quantum phenomena all around us.
I'll get into that a little bit later. I want to say goodbye and thank you. Jacob, how many people do you need to play this game for it to help you?
That's a fantastic question. We had 10,000 people playing for the Nature results that we published 2 weeks ago. Since then, 100,000 people have come in and played the games, and we're just excited to every day plot the results of these new players, and we just every day, day by day, we move the boundary of how good solutions players can find. So what is the ultimate limit? We thought that the ultimate limit was way much worse a year ago, so we're just waiting, anxious to see when people come in and play and give us better results.
Well, I think we might be able to send a couple more people your way listening to our audience of 2 million here might be able to come over and play your game. I hope we don't melt your server. It's the game is, check it out, at scienceathome.org. Jacob Scherzen, thank you for taking time to be with us today, and good luck to you on your game.
Thank you very much.
Jacob is director of the Interdisciplinary Center at Aarhus University in Denmark and associate professor of quantum physics there. Still with me are Shohini Ghosh and George Musser. George is author of Spooky Action at a Distance. We have lots of folks who want to ask questions because this is such a difficult concept to grasp. So let me see if I can get a couple of things here, a couple of people on the air out of the way. Where should we go? Okay, let's go to Alabama, Opelika, Alabama. Robert, welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, hi. Thanks. Great program.
Thank you.
Here's my comment regarding this heads-tails metaphor that you have for the coins. It seems to me you can only make this claim that once they're correlated, a measurement of heads on one side gives another measurement of heads on the other side, no matter how distant. The only way you can make that claim is if you can be sure that there hasn't been an interaction with a third body in the meantime. And so it seems to me these claims are rather extravagant because you say, well, some even across the universe, you know, this once this one is flipped, the other one is flipped and bound to get the same result. That would be difficult to prove.
You've hit the nail right on the head, I think, in the question that we're facing. Isn't that right, Shohini?
Yes and no. So it's a very good point that if you have other things like the environment or other particles that interact with these two entangled particles, that has a huge impact. In fact, usually it will completely destroy that connection. Mm-hmm. It's a process that we call decoherence. So, in fact, we would know if such something like this happened because when we do the experiment and we try to correlate the, you know, the measurements of heads and tails, we would find that they don't actually match up. Mm-hmm. So that's how we would know that there's been something else that is impacting this experiment.
But the fact, George, that there is nothing else impacting the experiment leaves open the question of how is it happening?
Well, exactly right. I mean, one word, Robert, to focus on is the word in the meantime, or a phrase in the meantime. Often in these experiments, there is no meantime. These, as Ira was saying earlier, these experiments are conducted in complete the same time, simultaneous with one another. So there's no time for any putative mechanism to transmit that influence.
Could that mean, and I said this before, but it seems to me a logical solution, as you mentioned in your book, is that they're really not separated, is that distance is our own concept, but it may be another dimension somewhere where they're not separated and they're communicating.
Yeah, and I want to emphasize this isn't the first thing you would leap to in your
but
you'll go to something exactly what Robert's saying. You would look for a more prosaic explanation for it, and they did. And for decades, they've been looking and looking and looking and ruling out, crossing out all the ideas on their experimental lab book list. And they're kind of driven to these extravagant options.
Yeah. Shohini, do you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. I think everybody who actually works in the field and in quantum physics hopes one day we will find some evidence that will allow us to actually move away from this theory because it's so weird. But so far, we haven't. We've been trying, as George said, we've been trying to figure out a common sense way of understanding things. And we haven't got there. On the other hand, we are very careful about making sure that there really is something weird there and that it's not just all in our heads or just weird math.
Yeah.
So, for example, yes, we cannot. We know for sure that we cannot communicate faster than light using this entanglement. We've been able to show that, test it, and also mathematically prove it. However, that doesn't mean we can't do other tasks. So we can actually set up scenarios, kind of like games that you can play where Alice has one of the particles and Bob has another one of these entangled particles. And then we can set up some kind of game with some winning strategies and try to figure out if these particles will help Alice and Bob win more than if there was no entanglement. And it turns out you can, in fact, do things better than you can without entanglement. So it's absolutely a real thing. It's not just some strange thing that we can ignore. It's definitely been tested in many ways.
Let's go to the phones to Ocean Pines, Maryland. Dan, hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on. Ira, I love your show.
Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for doing it. real quick, I know I missed the very beginning of the program, and I apologize if I sound crazy. Doesn't spooky action require free will? And if there is no free will, isn't it possible that there's something like super determinism that exists? I think Gerard DeHoof, and I probably mispronunciated his name, but I think he postulated that there's a super determinism and there's a physics underlying quantum that we don't understand yet. Is that something that's possible?
George, you're shaking sort of your head a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, this is actually, I talked to Ed Hooft at great length about it and actually discussed that in the book a little bit, and it is an option.
Explain that a little to our audience.
So the idea is that, I mean, one way to explain in a prosaic way the outcomes of these experiments is that the particles somehow know what is going to happen to them. They have some kind of, you could think of it almost as like clairvoyance of that outcome. Now, you don't really think it's clairvoyance. You begin to wonder, well, how could they know? Well, they could cheat. Someone could have slipped them the answer in advance. And that's kind of what superdeterminism does. It says that what's happening in the detectors or the precursors of those detectors is somehow correlated with what is going on in the act of creating the particles. So they're kind of, there's a something like a common cause that's accounting for the outcomes that we see. And you'd have to trace that common cause way back, certainly before the experiment was conducted, probably right back to the origins of the universe. So somehow the universe was set up in a way that, although the Earth didn't exist yet, those particles, when they met on that place called Earth, would exhibit these correlations. So it's kind of this weird, you know, conspiratorial explanation for it, but it is in principle possible, and there are experiments to try to at least push the how far back you'd have to have the conspiracy to do that.
This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. I'm Ira Flatow talking about quantum physics with Shohini Ghosh and George Musser, author of A Spooky Action at a Distance. We have just a few minutes left, but I want to get into something that's really central in your book we haven't talked about, and that is black holes. Black holes, you say in your book, is the opposite of the Big Bang theory. Everything gets sucked in as instead of exploding.
Well, I wouldn't say it's opposite of the Big Bang theory.
The Big Bang?
In a sense, it's the opposite of the Big Bang because the Big Bang, everything kind of went away from it in a way. I mean, we have to modify that, but you can think of it as an explosion outwards in some sense. And the black hole is kind of the opposite. Things are going into it. But here's the thing about black holes. We know they're weird. We know you die. All the things about black holes that you see in science fiction are all based in theory. But they're also the number one test case we have in contemporary physics for a quantum theory of gravity. They're the thing that actually you invent a quantum theory of gravity to try to explain because they involve various paradoxes that Stephen Hawking really made his name discovering. And one implication of the theory that I'm putting forward in the book is that the black hole may actually represent kind of a boundary to space or even to space and time. In a sense, space and time melt inside a black hole and they transform into some new phase, just as an ice cube might melt and form water. Something like that may happen in a black hole too.
And what happens to all the information that gets sucked in the black hole?
That is exactly the issue here. And that's actually why people are driven to this seemingly odd view of black holes is a melting of space-time to preserve the information because as far as we can tell, that is a sacrosanct principle in the natural world is that information is preserved, which is, by the way, the way to really think about it, I like to think about it, is everything in the world is reversible. If I make something, I can break it. If I can go left, I can go right. And the black hole also should be reversible. Things that fall in should be able to come out in some form or other. And in order to make that possible, in order to preserve the information in those objects. Maybe you need some new form of matter to do that.
Which we don't know about.
We do not know about. And in fact, you kind of don't want to know about it because you had to fall into a black hole to discover it. Yeah.
Shohini, how do you get your wrap your head around all of this stuff?
Black hole. It's definitely a challenge to do that. But yeah, I agree with George that, you know, the way physics progresses is when we find an exception to our model, you know, something where we cannot explain what we see. And black holes are exactly that, because a black hole is an object which is predicted, you know, for massive objects by general relativity. So that is where we expect, you know, the laws of gravity to work, which is basically relativity at work. However, if you talk about what's happening inside the black hole, we assume that all of this mass is acting at very, very microscopic scales, but that's where we have to apply the laws of quantum physics. So this is why black holes are this very, very special thing where we need to be able to apply two different laws and we don't know how to make them fit. Yeah. So it's this example of something outside of our physics. And that's why it's so interesting, because that will help us modify our theories. If we can observe, for example, radiation from a black hole, that will tell us more about what's happening in terms of information loss, as George mentioned. However, of course, that's a very challenging thing to do, but not impossible. So
we're going to talk lots more about this, because it's a fascinating topic, and it takes more than 1 hour of Science Friday. I want to thank George Musser, author of Spooky Action at a Distance. We have an excerpt of his book on our website at sciencefriday.com/spookyaction. And Shohini Ghosh, who is director of the Center for Women in Science at Wilfrid Laurier University in Waterloo, Canada. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today. And on our website, if you want to investigate this hidden particle world at home, you can make your very own particle detector. We have a cloud chamber up there. Check out the experiment at sciencefriday.com/cloud chamber. And before we go, hey, New York, get ready to play Science Friday trivia.
In 2007, what New York City waterway tested positive for gonorrhea?
Gowanus Canal.
Oh, I heard the correct answer. It is the Gowanus Canal. The Gowanus Canal has gonorrhea.
Oh, it does. That's right. We're hosting our second annual trivia night. It's going to get dangerous. 8 p.m. Wednesday, May 18th. At the Bell House in Brooklyn. Reserve your spot early. You can bring a whole team along. Head over to sciencefriday.com/trivia for more information and to reserve your tickets at sciencefriday.com/trivia. Charles Berkowitz is our director, senior producer Christopher Taliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Annie Minoff, Christy Taylor. Lou Groskin is our video producer. Our digital teams include, Julie Laback. We'll talk more about that later. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.